The Secrets of Star Trek is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to The Secrets of Star Trek, where we discuss the hidden layers and deeper meanings found in all the Star Trek TV series, movies, and more. And today we're discussing the Enterprise episode, Desert Crossing. I'm Dom Bettinelli, and joining me today on the panel are Father Corey Stika. Hey, Father Corey.
How's it going?
And Jimmy Akin. Hey, Jimmy.
Howdy, Dom.
Folks, be sure to stick around to the end of the episode. We have more listener feedback. And I want to encourage you, if you want to get your very own Secrets of Star Trek t-shirt, like the one I'm wearing on the video today, you can get that at sqpn.com/merch, M-E-R-C-H, as well as all kinds of other great gear and merchandise with various logos on it. And
you know, Dom, it's great you're wearing the shirt, but it's weird seeing two of me in the stream instead of just one.
I know. The way the camera's set up, like, I can see Jimmy's hat and you.
And me.
And before we get into today's show, I want to tell you about another show on the StarQuest Network you're sure to enjoy called The Secrets of Middle Earth, which you can find wherever fine podcasts are found or at sqpn.com/Middle Earth. And Jimmy, can you give us a recap of Desert Crossing?
This week, the Enterprise helps an alien named Zobral repair his ship, and he invites Captain Archer and Trip down to his home on a desert planet for a thank you meal. However, Zobral has ulterior motives. The planet is in the midst of a political conflict and views the alien, meaning Zobral himself, as a terrorist. However, he seems like a good host and wants Archer's help. The authorities then attack his home, and Archer and Trip must cross the desert by themselves. And because he's the hero of the show, Archer must help Trip survive while the alien authorities are attacking them. Eventually, Zobral helps T'Pol and Malcolm pilot a shuttle down to rescue them. The end.
It's pretty quick. Also, the name is pretty right on. It's on the nose. Father Corey, your impression of this one?
By and large, it's an okay episode. It's an episode. It's an episode of episodes. I mean, Clancy Brown is the best part of it. Clancy Brown is awesome. But beyond that, it's an episode.
Jimmy, how about you?
It was better than I expected. I didn't really have a clear memory of this from having seen it in the past. I've seen it, but it's been years. And just based on the name, I thought, oh no, it's another desert survival story. Like Final Mission with the TNG episode, which is where Wesley leaves for Star Trek Academy. But 8 minutes into the episode, they get stranded in a desert, and we've got this extended desert survival story. And okay, I'm not really interested in survival stories usually. I'm interested in things that involve interpersonal conflict and stuff like that. Man versus the elements is not my favorite type of story. But I was pleasantly surprised in this one because the desert crossing doesn't begin until halfway through.
Yep.
It's not like Final Mission where 8 minutes in and we're stranded. In this one, you've got a whole first half that is devoted to these characters and how they relate, and they come down and they have dinner and they play space volleyball. And, you know, we have this growing sense of something's going on here, but we're not sure what. And so the desert crossing itself is shorter than, so i.e. the part I'm least interested in is shorter than I would have expected. And so I correspondingly like the episode more. And I like the fact that we end up with a kind of ambiguous situation because, okay, it looks like there is this political conflict on this planet, and the authorities do view Zobral as a terrorist. But if he's a terrorist, which we don't have any proof of, he's a good-hearted guy who seems moral and is genuinely concerned about Archer and Trip and he does want their help in the battle against the authorities, but he's a decent guy. And by the end of it, because Archer doesn't have authority to intervene in these matters. And this is all kind of dancing around the Prime Directive, you know, and at the end of the episode, Archer has to say to him, you know, even if I was the warrior you thought I was, that's not why we're out here. And so he denies Zobral at the end the help, the military help that Zobral wanted, even though Zobral rescued him. And T'Pol turns to Archer and says, you know, it is better for the governments to decide whether to intervene in wars. And Archer says, yeah, I know. I just have a feeling that his cause was one worth fighting for. And I like that ambiguity and that respect for, yeah, it really should be governments deciding when to intervene in a war and when not to. Mm.
So I think this was my first time seeing this. I had no memory of this episode. Mm-hmm. I mean, I usually have at least a vague memory of most of them, but this one I had no memory of. So it's kind of interesting. I'm not sure what happened in 2000, whatever, when it came out, 2002. But in any case, what was that, Father Corey?
I was going to say, or it was just such a not so memorable episode.
It could be. Clancy Brown. I love Clancy Brown whenever he's in, you know, right from when he was the Kurgan in the Highlander. always love to see him show up. And definitely got Lawrence of Arabia vibes from this one. You know, the desert tribe fighting against the oppressive, you know, they're not colonizers in this one, clearly, but you know, the oppressive, more developed government. The whole desert, Jimmy, I agree with you on the desert crossing stuff. Like the surviving the desert thing, it gets tedious. The oh, look, someone walking interminably across sand dunes. I know that's the desert.
Someone thirsting, someone getting injured and using a cactus or whatever.
Falling down face first into the sand. You know, like they have to fall face into the sand so that there's sand covering their face because it's so uncomfortable to see someone do that. Like every director does that shot. I don't know what it is, but apart from that, I agree with both of you. You know, there are elements to this that make it go beyond that sort of thing. And, you know, there's some enjoyable ethical questions and some enjoyable interplay that happens, very similar to that recent one where we had the rescue of the Suliban from a camp, you know, kind of raising the question, who's the good guy? Who's the bad guy? This is not always cut and dried. And of course, that was a key part of this episode, was the Suliban.
Right, because that's what led Zobral to be interested in Archer, was he heard he broke these Suliban out of prison. And so I like that they have a continuing arc and consequences from previous episodes.
Well, yes.
Because they didn't do that originally.
Yeah. Well, this is towards the end of this first season, so it kind of acts like a flashback episode in that aspect of, here's some of the things that happened along the way throughout this past season.
Sure.
But they did it well. It wasn't a traditional flashback like Stargate would do, where literally they have like 5 minutes of plot and then just do flashbacks all the way through.
Right. It's not a clip show. So they're still heading to Ryza. That's another thing that we've got this journey to Ryza arc going. It's three episodes where they keep getting, every time they're making progress, something like distracts them and they have to go deal with it. Another distress signal.
Just, you know, fan service.
You know, we have, there's some tropes. You know, the Zobral is the cliche, a little bit of a cliche of the avuncular and overly friendly alien who is in need and then is suspiciously grateful, like way over grateful.
Well, and it almost sounds like it's a setup. They really never say it, but it seems like he realized that Enterprise was coming his way, so he purposely put him in the position that needed to get their help, get their attention. Right.
You know, and it's the old thing of your first impressions can be deceiving. And in fact, Zobral ends up being more complex than just, you know, he's trying to trick the Enterprise to steal technology or whatever, you know, that old thing. It's more, you know, there's more to it than that. So that's good. I do notice that when Archer wants Trip to come down for the dinner, he promises him that we won't be sitting out in the desert suffering from thirst and eating nasty things.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what happens. Yeah. So a broken promise there. And we do get that the usual meal of exotic strange foods that you get.
Yeah, including the essence of the male, chopped and seasoned.
Right.
AKA, as we would call it, Rocky Mountain oysters.
Yeah, right. You know, it's kind of interesting how they don't do that sort of exotic strange meal for more advanced technologically advanced cultures and that sort of thing. But they're doing it with this more primitive culture. I wonder is it that with an audience we're sort of prepped to see, you know, it's sort of an expectation from these more closer to the earth, primitive cultures?
Well, it may be the fact that we're living in the early 21st century now, and most of what we eat is highly processed food.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so the idea of eating every part of an animal is so waste not, want not, because mm-hmm. you live in a scarcity environment, is unfamiliar to us. And we would expect anyone as advanced as we are to be eating highly processed Big Macs and stuff we're used to. So,
true.
You know.
Well, and they really didn't say that the planet itself was lesser developed, because they had, you know, shuttlecraft, they had, you know, plasma weapons, things like that, you know.
Right.
So energy weapons, stuff like that. So it was that these people were living much close more primitive lives, because yeah. they were chased out of civilization, basically.
Right, right. And there is a sense that this is not a monoculture planet. You know, this is actually a planet that has multiple, you know, cultures and you know, differences among the people.
It's not Tatooine either. You know, joked about that at the beginning, as we're going to watch about Tatooine, but this isn't. This is a planet where it has a large desert, as Earth does, multiple large deserts.
Right.
And this just happens to be one of them.
Yeah. It's just bigger, like much more desert to it. Like the amount of desert on their planet would be compared to the amount of water on ours in this sense, right. In that sense. You know, so,
Zobral is amazed when he asks, and Trip tells him Earth is, you know, 2/3 surface water.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. To him, that would seem like, oh, a water planet.
Yeah.
That's what we are.
Earth kind of is.
Yeah. So they end up playing this game called Giscana. It doesn't look so much as like volleyball, but more kind of like lacrosse.
Yeah.
Crossed with Quidditch.
Space lacrosse.
I described it as sort of tennis plus basketball.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's very physical. And it's shirts versus skins under that sun. That would be, man.
Which they tell us is 41 degrees Celsius, which would work out to 106 degrees in real temperatures.
And then working that hard? I'm hoping Phlox gave them like some Triox compound and something to put on their skin. Because Trip and Archer are not all that, Southern Mediterranean like me. They're going to burn.
Well, and they do. I mean, you see them and they're pretty red by the end of it. You know, they did the makeup and make them look red. At least we didn't get the decon scene.
Right. We don't want them deconning each other in the that would be too much. So, you know, we get to the heart of the matter when, you know, Zabral reveals, like, this is what we're here for is, I've heard this story that you rescued 3,000 Suliban from a concentration camp and, you know, took on hundreds of enemy warriors, which, you know, of course was an exaggeration. And here it lays out his case. You know, we are an oppressed people. You know, they apparently had a caste system in the past and they were the lowest caste, and they thought, yay, we're free finally. And turns out they
abolished the caste system.
Yeah.
And this actually reflects the situation in India now.
Mm-hmm.
Officially, the caste system is not in place, but practically, yeah, it's still there.
Yeah. The Dalits.
Mm-hmm. Dalits.
Dalits are
the untouchables.
The untouchables are still the low, you know, treated as such. And it's a similar situation. And they're sort of fighting back after having been oppressed by the upper classes. And Archer says, you know, he doesn't seem like a terrorist. And Zabral doesn't come across like a terrorist to us. I mean, he seems reasonable.
And I don't think they ever give us proof of him doing anything terroristic.
Right. I mean, it goes back to the old.
They do talk about he does talk about fighting back. That he is, you know, fighting.
But that's revolution. That's not terrorism.
Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly. It's not. It doesn't say that he's doing bombings of buildings or anything
civilians,
like that.
Civilians. Yeah.
Right. Right. There's this old saying: one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. But that's not necessarily true. I mean, someone who's a revolutionary freedom fighter can fight in such a way as to not target civilian populations and not cause terror as their tactic, to instead have a rebellion or revolution. So it's interesting. Now the government would call them terrorists because it suits their purpose, the oppressive government. He hints Sabral hints that he wants weapons, but he flatters Archer that he wants the advice of the great, you know, tactician Archer, who is, you know, clearly a great warrior. And he sort of disabuses him, like, you know, Malcolm's really the tactician.
Well, and even when he's up on the Enterprise, Malcolm's like, no, I'm the tactician. I'm the one, you know, I'm the one who did these tactics, not him.
And it was only a few, you know, guards who kind of basically cowered in the corner once things started going wrong.
Yeah.
It's not like it was a great battle. It's interesting. The encampment is right there out in the open. Like, why wouldn't the bad guys, I don't even know if they had a name.
The bad guys are the Tarothans.
Tarothans, right. Why wouldn't they just flattened it before? Like, why now?
This is a problem for Star Trek, you know, combat tactics. Yeah, you could drop a rod from God on them and they would be done.
Yeah, right.
Well, and they even have the technology to blank out all sensors, to basically, you know, radio jam all sensors. Mm-hmm. So that also means they've got the technology to have the sensors to find them in the first place.
Right. If you're spacefaring, you would have to have these sensors, which they clearly are. Also, you know, this is attack. Sabral hides them in the basement in, you know, the bomb shelter. So essentially there's a direct hit on the village. They emerge and the village is flattened. It's like bad. Mm-hmm. And they're like, we got to get out of here.
By the way, I like that Sabral, cause they could have played it as, okay, we're being attacked. Now you have to fight with us.
Yeah.
And they didn't. They said, oh no, you're our guests. We've got to put you in the basement so you can hide out this attack. We want you safe.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. That was nice.
I like the way you phrase it too. Something to the extent of, it wouldn't be good hospitality to let my guests get killed in the bombardment.
Right, right. So Trip and Tucker, I mean Trip and Archer, take off across the desert after grabbing a couple bottles of water out of the shuttle. Why wouldn't they just take the shuttle away? I mean,
they said that the thrusters of the shuttle would get picked up by the attackers,
I guess. Yeah.
And so, but you know, if you would hope that they would have some sort of combat training in, you know, how to get the shuttle off the ground and gone in 5 seconds or less type of deal, you know,
right.
What's the quick startup routine so that there's not a chance of that happening?
Yeah. It just seemed, it seemed odd to take your chances in the desert. Yeah. You know, there is a scene on board the Enterprise too, that when this is all going down, T'Pol is in charge in the absence of the captain and Trip. She and Hoshi have this discussion of the dangers of first contact, where, as T'Pol puts it, you appear to take sides just by sitting down who you sit down with first. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's a good point. If aliens were to come to Earth and they show up in Washington, D.C., you know, Moscow and Beijing are not going to be happy about it. And vice versa. If aliens come to Earth and they sit down in Moscow with Putin first, we'd be pretty worried about what he's telling them. And yes, so I can imagine that.
Which is why Vulcans chose the best place to land. Bozeman, Montana.
Yes. Why Montana? Is Hoshi says.
Why not Montana?
It's the most beautiful place of all. Why not?
It's Montana's perfection.
Yeah, I mean, that's where the launch was from the warp ship. But, you know, hey. Well,
speaking of beautiful locations, I want to point out that they filmed the desert sequences in this in Imperial County, California, near Yuma, Arizona, which is where they have sand dunes, and they really are, you know, blowy sand dunes. I've driven through them any number of times, and the sand will be blowing across the highway as you're driving through this part of the desert.
That is wild. Yeah, I was kind of curious where they would have filmed. I assume that's where a lot of productions must go.
It's one of the best places in California. It's where the film industry is. It's one of the best places for sand dune environments, because there used to be an ancient prehistoric lake here called Lake Cahuilla, but it's dried up now, except for the Salton Sea. Where you don't really want to film, even though there was a movie called The Monster That Challenged the World in the 1950s that really only challenged part of Imperial County because it came out of the Salton Sea. But there's, because of that former, you know, lake environment, it over ages and ages and ages, there's loads of sand as a result.
Right. And it was in this conversation with Hoshi and T'Pol that T'Pol mentions that Vulcans have some directives that help guide them, and that Archer will need to develop his own directives for how to handle them. So this is a reference again to the Prime Directive eventually, which I don't know. Would the Prime Directive still, I mean, it is a warp capable civilization.
It depends on which version of the Prime Directive you're talking about, because it gets taken multiple different ways.
Yeah,
it begins in the original series simply as just don't spill the beans on aliens to a pre-warp civilization. And then by next gen, it becomes this complex, don't interfere with the natural development of other cultures.
Right.
Would be just more non-interference policy. Because, I mean, even you wouldn't even say like the development of alien cultures, just don't interfere in alien wars.
Right. And it's an interesting that interesting discussion, as you mentioned, about how decisions in regarding conflict should be decided by governments, not starship captains. And this was an issue in the early 19th century when British sea captains were the crown wherever they went, and they made these decisions at sea.
Even if they were pirates, they were the British crown some of the time.
and so they were making government policy decisions, diplomatic decisions on their own when they were way out there. So, the Enterprise is not so far out that they can't talk to Earth, as we saw last time when Archer talked with Admiral Forrester. So it's.
Well, they're dropping subspace repeaters as they go. So,
yeah. So, she has a good point. And Archer, I think, recognizes that he shouldn't. It's a complex situation. Is he really the best one qualified to make that decision? Having been through this, he's not exactly objective on this one either. The Tarathians were shooting at him. So T'Pol also uses some interesting psychology on Zabral when she convinces him that he is as responsible for Tucker and Archer as he is for his own men. Like, just you brought them there. And, she kind of recognizes you brought them there. So you are responsible for their fate, for their well-being and getting them out of there. Because they need him to pilot the shuttle through the gaps in the Tarathian sensor net, et cetera, to get down and get them. But I like how she kind of, mental jujitsu's Zabral on that one. Mm-hmm. A little interesting fact, the scene when Trip and Archer are at night in that abandoned building.
Mm-hmm.
Is
before it gets longest, blown up, I assume you're talking?
Yes, it's eventually blown up. It is one continuous shot, and it is the longest single shot of all in all of Star Trek at 3 minutes and 41 seconds.
Oh, really?
I don't know. That's
they ain't got nothing on the X-Files episode Triangle.
Which did the whole thing in one shot?
No, it's not the whole thing, but because they've got commercial breaks.
Yeah.
Basically, each act is one shot.
It's wild.
It's it's a great comedy episode. It's wonderful
because you got to keep the flubs in. You got to roll. Yeah. It's like stage. If it's on stage, you can't redo the take. You just go.
No, it's just well written. I love it. It's my favorite episode of the X-Files.
I think I remember that one. Yeah, been a long time.
Mulder goes in search of the Bermuda Triangle, ends up in World War II with a World War II version of Scully. Protecting a scientist who knows how to make a bomb and ends up coming back. And he encounters all these World War II versions of people he knows.
Right.
And then ends up back in the early 21st century.
Right. I remember that now. So, as you mentioned, the end of this episode ends with the open-ended question, is Zabral a terrorist or not? Is he a good guy or not? And that's sort of, I think, I'm sure it's intentional to kind of make you think, what makes him a terrorist? What would make him a terrorist?
Although they write the other race or the other group as pretty so unsympathetic. Just unsympathetic and despicable. I mean, just like, no, you're there to join his war. So now if you even come close to the planet, we will destroy you. And it's just like no discussion whatsoever that no, this is a misunderstanding.
That's true.
It really is.
Yeah. Final thoughts, Father Corey?
Look at the bright side about having this episode now on the way to Ryzik, because the next episode is 2 days and two nights. So.
Wait, what's 2 days and two nights?
I forget the sick bay one.
Oh, night in sick bay?
No, I'm sorry, but it's another bad episode. It's the one on Ryza. But it's a bad episode.
Okay. It's not a night in sick bay, though. That was
not a
horrific.
Night in sick bay. No, sorry. I was misunderstood that. But yeah, it's not a good episode.
Okay. Jimmy, how about you? Any final thoughts?
There is no B plot in this. None. We do have a temporary, during the second half, we have a temporary separation into what's going up on the Enterprise and what are Trip and Archer doing down in the desert. But there is no B plot in this. It's all driven by the A plot. And so I thought that was quite interesting because normally you have your, on Star Trek, you have your A plot that is what the episode's about. And then you've got a side plot, the B plot. But this is all A plot.
Mm, that's true. That's true. Very focused.
We don't have anything about Hoshi gardening or anything like that, and, you know, as our B plot.
Right. That's true. That's true. To the benefit of the episode, I think. But all right. So let's move on to our feedback. This came in on our last discussion on Enterprise, the Fallen Hero. Mark Gillies on YouTube writes, "The handshake discussion caught my attention. I am a handshaker. I was taught to evaluate people by their handshake. I also have a powerful immune system, so I question when people won't shake my hand. This has become a hassle at mass during the sign of peace. It was okay during the COVID panic, but that's a thing of the past now. You go to shake hands and wish people peace, and they act like you're a leper, unclean. Gee, sorry I sat next to you."
Well, okay, so I am not a handshaker, and if you sit next to me at mass, I will be very happy at the sign of peace to give you the Vulcan salute. Yep. And I have been taught to judge people based on how well they execute the Vulcan salute. So,
yeah. Yeah, that's when during the pandemic, when everybody's told, "Oh, do the elbow bump."
Oh gosh.
I would always tell them, it's like, I don't do that. I do the Vulcan salute instead. So, I mean, brought a little humor into a very serious issue, but
yeah.
I'm not a handshaker at the sign of peace.
I'll be happy to do the Wakandan salute if you want. That's fine. It's just I'm not here to touch your hand.
Actually, watching Dune, I want to do the Arrakan salute where they sword up and then across your forehead.
Yes. Well, thank you, Mark, for the feedback. We appreciate that. And now we'd like to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create The Secrets of Star Trek, including Arthur D., Jason C., Kevin E., Ezekiel, and John B. Their generous tax-deductible donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue The Secrets of Star Trek and all the shows at StarQuest, and you can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. We'd also like to thank Victor Lambs, who edited this episode. So that's it from us. What did you think of Desert Crossing? You can let us know by commenting on the show at sqpn.com/trek, our Facebook page, facebook.com/StarQuestMedia. Send an email to trek@sqpn.com or visit our Discord community at sqpn.com/Discord or leave a comment after watching The Secrets of Star Trek on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/StarQuestMedia. We'll be back next time when we'll be discussing the original series episode, This Side of Paradise. Until then, Jimmy Akin.
Oh, psychedelic drug episode.
Yes. Thank you for joining me in sharing the secrets of Star Trek.
Thank you, and live long and prosper.
And Father Corey Stika, thank you as well.
Thank you, Dom.
And once again, I'm Dom Bettinelli. Thank you for listening to The Secrets of Star Trek on StarQuest. And remember, the cherry-flavored snow cones.